welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 11th of April, 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Well, I do apologise, we haven't been here for a couple of weeks, but we are here today to discuss the week's news and to get into our greatest Britons. And of course, I have with me today my co-host, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, actually. I'm feeling as fit as a fiddle and enjoying the new sunny weather, albeit slightly chilly, that we've been experiencing in recent days.
Yeah, it is. It's beautiful weather at the moment. It's finally warmed up. I've actually been able to switch the heating off. It is nice to see that the weather is improving and everybody is starting to get out and about. And there have been some calls for increases in COVID restrictions in some places, but thankfully they're keeping away from that. But what we have been hearing about is a lot of complaints about Rishi Sunak's wife, Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. I believe you've been looking into this, Max.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to make this too much an issue of complaint about Rishi Sunak's wife, because I think she, you know, she's not been in control of the situation, and I don't think the situation is either of her making or of Rishi Sunak's making. It's just that there is this issue of complex tax. Complex taxation that I think it would be worth our while discussing, because most people will have fairly simple tax affairs that are relatively straightforward, relatively transparent. There's very little to dispute about it. They earn a certain amount. They're allowed to have a certain amount of their earnings tax-free, and then they pay taxes on the balance above that. And if you earn more than sort of 50-ish thousand pound a year, then you'll be paying higher rate tax on top of that as well. And that's kind of the situation that exists. Where people are resident in the UK, where they live in the UK for more than 183 days of the year, and where they've got their permanent home here in the UK, then people will be paying taxes in the way that that I've just explained, in a very straightforward and transparent way. But also, there will be taxes on people who are not necessarily resident in the UK, but who have earnings in the UK. And there are rules relating to those as to whether or not they should pay the tax in the country in which the income is created, or should pay the tax here in the UK. And with most countries around the world, we have a double taxation agreement, which means that it'll be one or the other of those things. And so people don't end up, by and large, paying tax in one country, in both countries, where they pay tax in the country where the income is generated, and then pay tax again when that money is remitted here to the UK. But the area that I really wanted just to focus on is domicile and residence. And when I say the word domicile, most people listening to this will probably, their minds will be blank. They won't actually really know what domicile is. And you know, not because there's anything wrong with that. It's just that most people don't know what domicile is. And most people won't know what domicile is and how it differs from residence, and how residence differs from citizenship, and how domicile differs from nationality. Because what we've got here are four separate definitions, each of which that there is a large area of overlap relating to it in everyday practical terms. But there are distinctions between what domicile is and what nationality is, and citizenship and residence. And what's been created is a very complex set of rules, which seem almost inexplicable to the ordinary person. When you, if you were to go to the to Her Majesty's Revenue, to the gov.uk website first of all, and if you went there and you went there with a view, with the intention of looking at the rules on domicile, residence, and nationality, and taxation, whether the taxation is going to be on an arising basis or a remittance basis, you'll find page after page after page of very complicated tax rules. I mean, just with regard to the section that is on on domicile, there are three different types of domicile, and there are four different flow diagrams that are used to demonstrate for you to determine whether somebody is actually domiciled in the UK or whether they're not domiciled in the UK. And so what we've got are a set of very, very complicated rules. And these rules are rules which very often will leave you in a situation where which is quite ambiguous, because if you follow the flow diagrams, a lot of the end points on the flow diagrams end with you are probably domiciled outside the UK, or you are probably domiciled in the UK. And so there is, it's an area of tax law where, which, as I say, is very ambiguous. And from my experiences as a financial advisor in earlier life, I know that these tax rules were devised to make to create a situation in which wealthy foreigners would feel inclined to live in the UK and therefore spend a lot of their wealth in the UK, and perhaps therefore might be encouraged to start businesses and commercial enterprises in the UK. And as an inducement to get them to come to Britain and to do these things, there are these complicated tax rules that are devised in order to create a situation where those people are able to avoid paying as much tax as ordinary British people would pay if they were earning that same sort of money here in the UK. And I think that's wrong. I think that we shouldn't have a situation where our tax laws are set up in order to benefit foreign plutocrats at the in situations where the same rules don't apply to British people. And the point is, these rules are so complicated that it requires the people who are going to benefit from the rules to employ international tax consultants to argue the case with Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs. Because there are these flow diagrams, and the flow diagrams very often end up in being an ambiguous box where it's only probably one way or probably the other, what that then creates is a situation where if you want to benefit from these rules relating to domicile and residence, you need to employ an international tax consultant to constantly be representing you in meetings and in discussions with Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs in order that you can argue your case, because it's largely beyond most ordinary people to be able to argue their way through these rules and benefit. And so, but the key issue relating to Rishi Sunak and his wife basically boils down to the fact that as the Chancellor of the Exchequer, he is the person who directs Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, and who formulates the legislation under which Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs work. And his wife is at the same time, through no fault of her own, I would point out, is a person who is part of a very small elite who potentially stand to benefit from the rules that are created by the government department that is under the direction of her husband. Now, it's not the whole, this whole thing hasn't been created as a result of Rishi Sunak's direction, so there's been no wrongdoing on his part as far as this is concerned, because these complicated rules have been devised over a period of decades, probably even longer than that, perhaps even a period of centuries. But the fact of the matter is that it's put Rishi Sunak, in my view, in a situation where it could be argued that he's got a conflict of interest. And it may be that he's conducted himself impeccably, and I would hope that he has done. But the point is, it's still put him in a position of a conflict of interest, because he's in charge of the government department, effectively, that's responsible for framing the rules that determine whether somebody can be regarded as a non-domicile and can therefore benefit from these ambiguous tax rules. And that's really the point I wanted to make. So I think that this is an area of taxation that really needs to be reviewed. And I would hope that a future nationalist government would enthusiastically throw themselves into that, so that we can have a situation where these kind of ambiguities don't exist, and where British people are treated exactly the same as foreign plutocrats, and where foreign plutocrats aren't given a privileged position from a taxation point of view that can't be enjoyed by British people who are simply earning their daily, simply earning their living and paying their taxes as one would expect.
Yeah, because from what I've seen of it, it seems that she's only paying like 25% of the tax she would be paying in Britain in India, because she's an Indian domicile. And I've also seen a lot of other news reports that have been just complaining that that they have so much money. How are they going to know what it's like to be a poor person? And I think, well, all of the politicians have got lots of money. I don't think Rishi Sunak is any different to the rest of them. And another side to it is, why are people so concerned about what other people are paying in tax? It seems to me that there are far more important things going on, like immigration, for a start, or the sort of things that are being taught to children in schools. And yet the news is always full of, why isn't so-and-so paying his full amount of tax? It's like they're just trying to distract us away from the important things by saying people aren't paying a certain amount of tax. And people are always going to try and get away with paying the least amount of tax. And I don't think that Rishi Sunak or his wife will have been doing anything illegal. I think they would just have been trying to pay the least amount of tax, which is what everybody does. Everybody pays an accountant to do that. And if the government have put laws in place which make it so that people can do this and that, so that they end up paying less, then that's what people are going to do. And I guess you need to change the government or get the government to change those rules if they are particularly slack, which seems to be what you're saying there, Max, that the government should be changing these rules because it's possible to take advantage of them. And Rishi Sunak's wife may well have been taking advantage of it while being married to the Chancellor of the Exchequer. So there could be this conflict of interest. What do you think of the accusations that it's other Tories that have actually put this information out there?
That I don't know. I wouldn't imagine that. I wouldn't sort of immediately understand why they might decide to do that. But we've had a lot of scandals just recently with regard to Russian oligarchs. And but I, in my view, it's highly likely that any Russian oligarchs that have been living in the UK probably will have had non-domiciled status as well, because they would be the type of people who would are best positioned to benefit from these kind of tax situations. But I think that on a matter of principle, that politicians, particularly those who have who are in a senior position, i.e. cabinet ministers, it should be, the onus should be on cabinet ministers to so arrange their affairs that they're not seen as exploiting what could be described as deliberately ambiguous and complex loopholes that have been created in the tax system. And British cabinet ministers and their children and their spouses, in my view, the onus should be placed upon them for them to pay taxes in the same way as the vast majority of British people. And there shouldn't be areas like this relating to domicile and residence that are incredibly complicated and that appear to be deliberately ambiguous and complex relating to as kind of like legal contrivances. So they're legal, but there is still a contrivance that is a complicated contrivance the vast majority of people would have no understanding of, in order to avoid paying taxes that ordinary British people would otherwise have to pay. And I think that it's there should be this sense that the politicians that lead our country are in the same boat as we are. You know, and we're in a situation now where there's a lot of controversy over the cost of living, the fact the cost of living is going up, and it's going up largely because of the fact that the government bungled the pandemic situation, so that it cost us a heck of a lot more than it would have cost us had they just reacted sensibly to the pandemic. Now we're in a situation where the government are giving large amounts of money to the Ukrainian government to finance or to provide them with munitions, etc., so that they can continue with their battle with the Russians.
I think that's most of it, isn't it? These sanctions that they're putting on Russia, which is affecting everybody else, which is putting up the price of the gas, putting up the price of the fuel. And you mentioned the Russian oligarchs there. And of course, the Russian oligarchs just seem to be fair game. You can just take anything you want from them now. You know, all the investments, you can just steal them. Any investments people in Russia have made in the Western world, you can just steal them and just say, well, it's because they're Russia. It just seems like the rule of law has gone out of the window because of what's going on between Russia and Ukraine. And we've been accused of having a pro-Russia stance here at Radio Albion. And I know you have a different take on things over there, Max. So I was wondering if you wanted to talk a little bit about Britain and Ukraine and Russia, if you wanted.
Okay, well, let's just move on to that side of things. I think a lot of people have been quite impressed with Putin. And to be quite honest, I've been quite impressed with Putin in the past, in the fact that he was somebody who was a fairly lowly operative within the Russian secret service at the point where the Soviet Union, at the point where where the Soviet Union collapsed. And that he has, as a politician, expanded his influence and reached the point where he became the president and has maintained the presidency of Russia now for a great many years, and appears to have rebuilt Russia from being a complete basket case, as it was at the point of the collapse of the Soviet Union, to a point now where it is a strong country again. And I think over the years that a lot of people, as I say, myself included, we've been quite impressed by the fact that he's been able to do that. I think I was also impressed with the fact that he stepped in to support Bashar al-Assad in Syria, and because I felt that the way that the West was interfering in Syria was actually counterproductive, and that in my estimation, Bashar al-Assad has been a civilizing influence in Syria, and somebody who was very pro-Western initially, but who now is no longer pro-Western by virtue of the fact that the West effectively turned against him because of his opposition to the existence of the State of Israel. Putin did step in and assist Assad to retain his control of Syria, and the situation in Syria appears to be massively improved now. But what's happened since has been that what we've seen since the collapse of the Soviet Union is that the gradual increase in the number of European countries that are NATO members now. And the fact that the number of NATO members has increased steadily, whilst at the same time countries that used to be part of the Eastern Bloc under the Soviet Union have joined the European Union and have joined NATO. And that's been seen as something which is worrying by Putin. And so we've reached this sort of situation that existed about 6 weeks ago, where Putin was saying that he wanted the West to give Russia various assurances and was demanding those assurances. And those assurances weren't made. And so so Russia invaded Ukraine. And I think that the thing which I disapprove of in terms of what Putin's done there is the fact that he has initiated. He didn't necessarily create the preconditions for it. I think both sides created the preconditions for it, but he initiated a new brothers war, which I think is wrong and is something that that will tarnish his reputation for the rest of his life, effectively. Despite all the things that have been done, there was no need for him to do that. From the point of view of a white nationalist perspective, if you look at the government of the West and the government of Ukraine recently, comparing it with government in Russia, what we find is that in the West and in Ukraine, because one of the things that the news media were very quick to point out at various points, particularly during the early part of the conflict in Ukraine, was just how multicultural some of the larger centres of Ukraine have become. Nothing in comparison with the multiculturalism that exists here in the UK and in the United States, etc., but still significant. And what's happened is that within the Ukraine, as has happened throughout the whole of the rest of the West, governments have facilitated and promoted mass non-white immigration into their countries, displacing the native white populations. But the same thing has been done in Russia as well. There's been a lot of transfers of population from Central Asia into the European part of Russia, President Putin has in recent times expressed very pro-multicultural sentiments. So we've had multiculturalism promoted both in the West and also in Russia. We've had white nationalists labelled as dangerous Nazi extremists in the West and in Ukraine, but also in Russia. We've had legislation introduced to deny freedom of speech to people who are white nationalists, both in the West and Ukraine and also in Russia. One of the things we've seen in recent decades is the progressive militarization of the police here in the UK, and the fact that the police kind of act as the sort of paramilitary wing of the of the woke revolution in many cases here in the West. The same sort of thing has been happening in Russia. People that I've spoken to that are white nationalists that live in Russia and have lived in Russia have told me that the same sort of things exist over there as exist over here in the UK. We've allowed oligarchs and multinational corporations to pervert the course of politics here in the West. And in Russia, the same things have been allowed by Vladimir Putin as well, from what I can see. There's been the gradual corruption of our electoral system here in the West, to a point where people really can have no confidence in the impartiality of the electoral system. And the same thing exists in Russia. Both sides have also created military tensions. Russia created military tensions by invading Crimea. The NATO have created military tensions by recruiting and arming ex Eastern Bloc countries. So those tensions have been created. But as I say, it was Putin who initiated the Brothers' War. Putin's soldiers have caused absolute widespread devastation in Ukraine, which is totally unjustifiable. And there have been very large numbers of civilian deaths in the Ukraine, which could have been avoided. They didn't need to happen. And that's something, as I say, which I think will stain Putin's reputation for the rest of his days. Also, the military adventure of invading Ukraine has turned out to be something that's a lot more difficult and a lot more taxing than I think he had originally estimated. I think he vastly underestimated the fighting spirit of the Ukrainian people. And I think he will struggle to actually come out on top as far as this struggle is concerned, and there is a very real danger that that Ukraine will, to use the analogy that Boris Johnson tried to use the other day, will turn out to be the very spiny porcupine that proves to be indigestible by the aggressor.
Yeah, I mean, it could very well turn into a situation like Syria. I mean, it seems to me that they're just pumping weapons in there. They don't want it to be governable. They want to make it ungovernable. and a lawless war zone. Basically, I take your point there about no more brothers wars, and it's basically white people fighting against white people. And then you've got the governments of the West that are encouraging it and prolonging it, seeing how long they can get it to go on for. But I think Putin's goals, I think he's achieved most of them. I mean, the first goal was to secure Donbass and Luhansk and the Donbass area, basically, Donetsk and Luhansk, and secure that area. And that basically means taking Mariupol and the rest of that Donbass area. They wanted to demilitarize Ukraine, and they've done that. They took out all the airfields on the first day. That's why they keep having to bring new weaponry in from the West. And they wanted to, quote unquote, denazify the Ukraine. And what they meant by that is they wanted to take out the Azov Battalion. And the Azov Battalion is in Mariupol, obviously hidden behind civilian shields and human shields. That's why 90% of Mariupol has been flattened. I think once they've got the last of the Azov Battalion, that will be it. And they'll just secure that Donbass area and probably have elections. And they want to have these talks. They want Ukraine to say that it's not going to join NATO, which I think will probably happen. But I do think he's achieved most of his goals so far. And I think we're being given lots of propaganda here on the West. I mean, just as we're recording this today, they're talking about a missile that they have found, and the missile helpfully has Russian writing on it. You can't actually tell who the missile came from, who manufactured it, but somebody has helpfully written on it in chalk, "Kill all the children," in Russian, or words to that effect. I mean, it's just really, really clumsy propaganda that is being put out there by these militias. But yeah, I do take your point there, Max, about it being another brother's war, and it's Putin that has initiated it. So we'll just have to wait and see. I mean, they keep trying to keep it in the news. Boris Johnson is over there meeting up with Zelensky over the weekend. So is Zelensky really in Kiev? Because people have been saying, I think he's really in Tel Aviv. But it does look like he may actually be there in Kiev, because Boris Johnson is there talking to him today. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Just really, the most tragic thing about it is that the Ukrainian people have been provoked into fighting to save a political system that is corrupt, to stop their country from being conquered by a neighbouring country whose political system is corrupt. It's just a tragedy of the nth degree, in my view, that this fighting's taking place. Because either way, whether the Ukrainians win or whether Russia wins, what will happen is that there will continue to be the promotion of non-white immigration into those two countries. There still will be the promotion of multiculturalism. There still will be a situation where white nationalists are labelled as dangerous Nazi extremists. There still will be a situation where there will be legislation that will deny freedom of speech, where the electoral system is corrupted, where the police are militarised. And so, in reality, nothing much will have changed. But the thing that's happened as a result of the brothers' war being initiated is a situation now where really the people of Ukraine will just not accept rule from Russia, so that they won't accept a situation where the Ukraine is going to be dependent upon Russia, because of the fact that Russia have initiated this brothers' war, and because there have been so many deaths on their side which were unnecessary, and there's been so much devastation caused on their side which is totally unnecessary. And you can't wreak that sort of devastation and death on a country and then expect the people that live in that country to warmly welcome you as their saviours afterwards.
You know, it's interesting you say that there's this multiculturalism in Russia, but you've got Belarus there, which is 99.9% white, yet they have the militarized police force and they have the anti-free speech laws, and they still have quite a lot of leftovers from the Soviet Union, yet they're 99.9% white. So, I mean, I would look at that and say, well, that's great, you know, that they've achieved what needs to be achieved, and Lukashenko is preserving the nation. But I don't think he's supportive of white nationalism. I think, you know, if you're a white nationalist, you might be in the same sort of trouble that you are in Russia. But it is 99.9% white. So, and then it becomes a question of, are you just trying to preserve the ethnicity or preserve a certain way of life as well? Because we do have an example there where the ethnicity is preserved, but they don't quite have as much freedom as we have over here in the West.
And yet Lukashenko was taking refugees from the Middle East and was then trying to push them through across the border into Poland.
Yeah, he was doing that because the European Union sanctioned Belarus. So they said, well, we're no longer going to prevent Middle East refugees from getting into the EU. He said to them, well, you could always pay us the money to put them in the camps like you have paid to Turkey to put them in the camps over there. But the EU didn't want to do that. So he just pushed them on through into Poland. I think that was done with his sort of tongue in his cheek. You know, don't you want this diversity? I thought this diversity was a wonderful strength and vibrancy and enriching Poland. Go on, have this diversity, and sort of pushing them across the border there. I think what's actually happened.
I appreciate why he may have done that, but I don't think that that's actually helped the situation at all.
No. But I think what's actually happened there, because if you notice, we no longer hear about these refugees trying to get into Poland. But what we do hear about is lots of Ukrainian refugees that turn out to be black and that have been given Ukrainian citizenship very recently. And Ukraine is just on that border there. So instead of going through into Poland, I think the same Middle Eastern and black refugees that were going from Belarus into Poland, I think they've been heading on down into Ukraine and then working their way into Poland from Ukraine. And they've been getting in that way.
I'm sure that's the case. And one of the things that I sort of identified when this conflict started was that the refugee situation in terms of the Ukrainian people fleeing the war would be used in order to create the circumstances where further non-white immigration into Europe could follow subsequently. And so we've had people in this country saying, oh, well, why are we trying to make it so easy for Ukrainian refugees to get into Europe when there's all these refugees from Africa and from Asia that want to come into Europe? And so, you know, they've been very quick to do that. And again, that's a consequence of this war, which I think will be damaging for the future. And something which is to be regretted.
Definitely. Well, should we go back in the past then to better times? Should we talk about our greatest Britons, Max?
Let's do that, yes.
Yeah, let's talk about Elizabeth I. And in the last episode, we heard how traumatic Elizabeth's early life was, with her mother being beheaded and her adopted father trying to take advantage of her. She was a keen student, learning to speak a number of languages in her youth and translating works from Greek and Latin. Her Catholic sister was eventually made queen, but the public had more support for Elizabeth. And when Mary died without providing an heir, Elizabeth was finally made queen. In her coronation speech, she made mention of intending to do whatever she could to provide comfort to the posterity of her nation, showing an understanding of her role to improve conditions for the next generation born to her ethnicity. And I thought that was very important, the wording that she used, that the posterity of the nation. So it shows that talking about ethnicity, and ethnicity does come into the story later on here as well, as we will see. Is there anything else you want to bring up or remember about Elizabeth I before we start, Max?
No, I don't think so. I mean, posterity, obviously, meaning the future generations of our kind. And so the use of words like posterity there are significant.
Yeah, it's a great word to use. We find that used in the American Constitution as well, and abused today to say that it actually means everyone. It doesn't. It means the next generations born to you. Well, Elizabeth's personal religious convictions have been much debated by scholars. She was a Protestant, but kept Catholic symbols such as the crucifix and downplayed the role of sermons in defiance of a key Protestant belief. Elizabeth and her advisers perceived the threat of a Catholic crusade against heretical England, and the Queen therefore sought a Protestant solution that would not offend Catholics too greatly while addressing the desires of the English Protestants. The one thing she would not do, though, is tolerate the Puritans, who were pushing for far-reaching reforms. As a result, the Parliament of 1559 started to legislate for a church, based on the Protestant settlement of Edward VI, with the monarch as its head, but with many Catholic elements, such as vestments. All public officials were now to swear an oath of loyalty to the monarch as the supreme governor of the church, or risk disqualification from office, while the heresy laws were repealed to avoid a repeat of the persecution of dissenters that was practiced by Mary. So this was very diplomatic of her, basically. She's getting everybody to take an oath to her, because, of course, the Catholics, they're loyal to the pontiff, and this was the source of the problems, really, was this loyalty to the Pope instead of loyalty to the monarch. And it's good that she's refusing to tolerate the Puritans, who were the ones that wanted to smash everything up, basically. The early Bolsheviks, I think the Puritans were, caused all sorts of problems in Ireland, caused all sorts of problems in the Reformation. And yeah, she would not tolerate these Puritans. And she's keeping some of the trappings of the church so that it still looks the same, but slowly moving it into Protestantism, and with her at the head of it. Even though, I mean, the monarch may not know that much about religion, I guess that was a response to the Catholic being the Pope being the head of the Catholic Church, which was seen as an international institution by this time that was interfering with the sovereignty of other nations, rather than being something that was separate from other nations. And there was this dislike of Mary because of the way that she treated the Catholics. And that was one of the reasons why people wanted to see Elizabeth on the throne, because they thought that she would be a little bit milder and try to bring the two sides together, which I think she really succeeded in doing. And if you know much about this time, Max, do you want to add any comments to that?
I'm not particularly knowledgeable about this time, other than that the Puritans were very straight-laced. The Puritans, from what I can recall, didn't like great ornamentation. They wanted their churches to be very simple affairs. They were fairly sort of dour and what's the word I'm thinking of here? Dour and humorless in many respects. And they also had some quite sort of bizarre names for people. I can remember reading that there was a person who was called In Pieces Before the Lord. That was his name, and things like that. And they... I think the early Puritans used to interpret the Bible absolutely literally, and that tended to cause problems as well.
Yeah, I think they tried to ban Christmas. You say they didn't like the merrymaking. Yeah, they tried to ban Christmas, right, and dancing and all sorts. Yeah, real killjoys they were. Well, marriage negotiations constituted a key element in Elizabeth's foreign policy, and she turned down many requests after serious negotiations, once telling an imperial envoy, "If I follow the inclination of my nature, it is this, beggar woman and single, far rather than queen and married." And she must have been highly sought after as somebody to marry, being the Queen of England. And I guess there must have been a lot of machinations as well, trying to get her to marry somebody from a certain country so that they would get favour. The people from that country would then get favour in England. In 1570, senior figures in the government privately accepted that Elizabeth would never marry or name a successor. And for her failure to marry, Elizabeth was often accused of irresponsibility. Her silence, however, strengthened her own political security, for she knew that if she named an heir, her throne would be vulnerable to a coup. She remembered the way that a second person, as I have been, had been used as the focus of plots against her predecessor. And she was. They tried to implicate her in all sorts of plots to get rid of Mary and put Elizabeth on the throne. And people tried to marry her as well, didn't they, before then? And there was somebody that was put to death for plotting a coup. Elizabeth's unmarried status inspired a cult of virginity related to that of the Virgin Mary, and in poetry and portraiture, she was depicted as a virgin or a goddess or both, not as a normal woman. At first, only Elizabeth made a virtue of her ostensible virginity, and in 1559 she told the Commons, And in the end, this shall be for me sufficient, that a marble stone shall declare that a queen, having reigned such a time, lived and died a virgin. Later on, poets and writers took up the theme and developed an iconography that exalted Elizabeth, and ultimately she would insist that she was married to her kingdom and subjects, and because of that, under divine protection. In 1599, she spoke of all my husbands, all my good people. And I mean, this is long been associated with the king or the queen, that they're actually married to the kingdom and married to their subjects. And she was sort of putting this quite literally. And I do think it's interesting that she was a virgin. It's quite kind of like having a nun as the queen. And she really does stand out throughout the whole of history for this, I think. Have you got any comments on it, Max?
I think some people have suggested that she did actually have affairs, but never became pregnant. That's a possibility. But I think that one of the things that she appears to have done is to, as you say, have projected this this image of herself as being almost otherworldly and almost in her position by divine right. And she developed this way of dressing with, you know, what was quite obviously power dressing, with the enormous ornate frilly collars to her dresses, the tight bodices, the very voluminous skirts, the fact that her hair was all sort of piled up on top of her head with various adornments, etc., and the fact that she used to whiten her skin to make herself look you know, somewhat otherworldly as well. So it was power dressing at its sort of 16th century peak, I think.
Yeah, she these images of her as well, they weren't quite realistic. They tended to exaggerate these features and make her look mysterious and supernatural. So I guess at the time she would have worn makeup as well to accentuate that. Well, Mary, Queen of Scots, caused problems for her, as the Catholics wanted to put her on the throne. Mary was Elizabeth's cousin, and Elizabeth moved quickly to try and get her married off to someone who would not be a threat to her own rule. And in 1563, Elizabeth proposed her own suitor, Robert Dudley, as a husband for Mary, without asking either of the two people concerned. Predictably, both proved unenthusiastic. And in 1565, Mary married Henry Stuart, Lord Darnley, who carried his own claim to the English throne. Again, it's interesting here. It means that basically, if you're the monarch, you can order somebody underneath you to marry who you want them to marry. So it shows that marriage was seen more like a business transaction or something for a dynastic transaction to ensure dynastic succession and to make certain that you had the person on the throne that you wanted. This is why they wanted Elizabeth to marry certain people, because they wanted an alliance between Britain and some of these other countries on the continent. This marriage was the first of a series of errors of judgment by Mary that handed the victory to the Scottish Protestants and to Elizabeth. Darnley quickly became unpopular and was murdered in February 1567 by conspirators, almost certainly led by James Hepburn, the 4th Earl of Bothwell. Shortly afterwards, on the 15th of May 1567, Mary married Bothwell, arousing suspicions that she had been party to the murder of her husband. Elizabeth confronted Mary about the marriage, writing to her, "How could a worse choice be made for your honour than in such haste to marry such a subject, who besides other and notorious lacks, public fame has charged with the murder of your late husband, besides the touching of yourself also in some part, though we trust in that behalf falsely." These events led rapidly to Mary's defeat and imprisonment in Loch Leven Castle. The Scottish lords forced her to abdicate in favour of her son James VI, who had been born in June 1566, who was then taken to Stirling Castle to be raised as a Protestant. Mary escaped from Loch Leven in 1568, but after another defeat, fled across the border into England, where she had once been assured of support from Elizabeth. Elizabeth's first instinct was to restore her fellow monarch, but she and her council instead chose to play safe. Rather than risk returning Mary to Scotland with an English army or sending her to France and the Catholic enemies of England, they detained her in England, where she was imprisoned for the next 19 years. Mary soon became the focus for rebellion, and in 1569 there was a major Catholic rising in the north, and the goal was to free Mary, marry her to Thomas Howard, 4th Duke of Norfolk, and put her on the English throne. After the rebels' defeat, over 750 of them were executed on Elizabeth's orders. But in the belief that the revolt had been successful, Pope Pius V issued a bull in 1570 titled Regnans in Excelsis, which declared Elizabeth, the pretended Queen of England and the servant of crime, to be excommunicated and a heretic, releasing all her subjects from any allegiance to her. Catholics who obeyed her orders were threatened with excommunication. This papal bull provoked legislative initiatives against Catholics by Parliament, which were, however, mitigated by Elizabeth's own intervention. In 1581, to convert English subjects to Catholicism with the intent to withdraw them from their allegiance to Elizabeth was made a treasonable offence, carrying the death penalty. From the 1570s, missionary priests from the continental seminaries were sent to England secretly in the cause of the reconversion of England, and many suffered execution, engendering a cult of martyrdom around them. Regnans in Excelsis gave English Catholics a strong incentive to look to Mary Stuart as the legitimate sovereign of England. Mary may not have been told of every Catholic plot to put her on the English throne, but from the Ridolfi plot of 1571, which caused Mary's suitor, the Duke of Norfolk, to lose his head, to the Babington plot of 1586, Elizabeth's spymaster, Sir Francis Walsingham, and the Royal Council keenly assembled a case against her. At first, Elizabeth resisted calls for Mary's death, but by late 1586, she had been persuaded to sanction her trial and execution on the evidence of letters written during the Babington plot. Elizabeth's proclamation of the sentence announced that the said Mary, pretending title to the same crown, had compassed and imagined within the same realm diverse things, tending to the hurt, death, and destruction of our royal person. On the 8th of February 1587, Mary was beheaded at Fotheringay Castle, Northamptonshire. After the execution, Elizabeth claimed that she had not intended for the signed execution warrant to be dispatched and blamed her secretary, William Davison, for implementing it without her knowledge. The sincerity of Elizabeth's remorse and whether or not she wanted to delay the warrant have been called into question both by her contemporaries and by later historians. Well, she does seem to be merciful there, doesn't she? She intervenes to prevent people being executed in that first plot. But then Mary just turned out to be too dangerous to have around. And the Pope really didn't help by telling all the Catholics that they should no longer be obeying Elizabeth. And Elizabeth was a heretic. So you can see the Pope interfering there. And, you know, this is the sort of reason why we stopped being Catholic. You know, a lot of people.
And Mary persistently manoeuvred to try and pair up with somebody else who had a claim to the English throne. So she, you know, this was the third time she'd blotted a copybook. And so on that basis, you can understand why Elizabeth had lost her patience with her.
Yeah, it's quite obvious what she was doing, marrying somebody with a claim to the English throne. Well, Elizabeth's foreign policy was largely defensive. The exception was with the English occupation of Le Havre from October 1562 to June 1563, which ended in failure when Elizabeth's Huguenot allies joined with the Catholics to retake the port. Elizabeth's intention had been to exchange Le Havre for Calais, lost to France in January 1558. Only through the activities of her fleets did Elizabeth pursue an aggressive policy, and this paid off in the war against Spain, 80% of which was fought at sea. She knighted Francis Drake after his circumnavigation of the globe from 1577 to 1580, and he won fame for his raids on Spanish ports and fleets. An element of piracy and self-enrichment drove the Elizabethan seafarers, over whom the Queen had little control. And there was a lot of piracy that was going on at the time. I mean, it might be worth looking at Francis Drake at some point here. And again, this shows that we used to have parts of France. Quite a few parts of France used to be managed by the King of England. And the problem was, because the King was in England, he would lose his claim in France, and then he'd have to raise an army, pay the taxes to pay the army, and then he'd have to go over to France, fight the war, secure the area again so that he was the sovereign again, and then there'd be a rebellion back in England, and he'd have to come back to England, and then he'd lose his properties in France. And this went on and on and on, and the public would be taxed every time in order to pay for these wars, and eventually we lost all our properties in France. But that's why Brittany is still called Brittany. But at one point, we had quite a few parts in France.
Not really from the Channel Islands. We've still got the Channel Islands, which are the last lingering little pieces of land.
Yeah, Jersey, Guernsey, and the Isle of Sark. Well, so Francis Drake had undertaken a major voyage against Spanish ports and ships in the Caribbean in 1585 and 1586. And in 1587, he made a successful raid on Cadiz, destroying the Spanish fleet of warships intended for the enterprise of England, just at the same time that Philip II of Spain had decided to take the war to England. On 12th of July, 1588, the Spanish Armada, a great fleet of ships, set sail for the Channel, planning to ferry a Spanish invasion force under the Duke of Parma to the coast of southeast England from the Netherlands. A combination of miscalculation, misfortune, and an attack of English fireships on the 29th of July off Gravelines, which dispersed the Spanish ships to the northeast, defeated the Armada, and the Armada straggled home to Spain in shattered remnants after disastrous losses on the coast of Ireland, after some ships had tried to struggle back to Spain via the North Sea and then back south past the west coast of Ireland. And I have heard that this was really down to a freak of the weather. I mean, they're talking about these fire ships that were sent off, but the winds must have blown them towards the Spanish ships, and also that a lot of these ships ended up getting wrecked at the time, if I remember. And wasn't this when Francis Drake was playing bowls on the ship, I believe?
There was a famous incident where Francis Drake was supposed to be playing bowls as the Armada sort of came over the horizon. From my recollection of history, that there was a distinct difference between the British ships, which became nicknamed the Wooden Wolves, and the Spanish ships, which were much larger, but which had a very broad draft and had very flat bottoms, because the Spanish were used to using those kind of ships in the Mediterranean, where there is very little in terms of rough sea. But once they got to the coasts of Britain and within sort of spitting distance of Britain, the seas obviously were a lot more choppy. And the difference in between the Spanish ships and the British ships was that the British ships were narrower and smaller, but they had much deeper keels, so that they were stable in the rough sea, which then meant that we could fire cannons far more accurately at the Spanish ships, whereas the Spanish ships, because of their flat bottoms, were rocking from side to side. So half the time they'd fire and their cannonballs would go like sort of straight up in the air, whereas the other half of the time their cannons pointing down towards the sea. And so that they were at a distinct disadvantage in terms of their stability in rough seas.
I did hear there was some problems when the seamen got back as well with actually being paid their wages. There was a bit of upset about this. Well, unaware of the Armada's fate, the English militias mustered to defend the country under the Earl of Leicester's command, and he invited Elizabeth to inspect her troops at Tilbury in Essex on the 8th of August. Wearing a silver breastplate over a white velvet dress, she addressed them in one of her most famous speeches. "My loving people, we have been persuaded by some that are careful of our safety to take heed how we commit ourselves to armed multitudes for fear of treachery. But I assure you, I do not desire to live to distrust my faithful and loving people. I know I have the body but of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king, and of a king of England too, and I think foul scorn that Parma or Spain or any prince of Europe should dare to invade the borders of my realm." When no invasion came, the nation rejoiced, and Elizabeth's procession to a Thanksgiving service at St. Paul's Cathedral rivaled that of her coronation as a spectacle. The defeat of the Armada was a potent propaganda victory, both for Elizabeth and for her Protestant England. The English took their delivery as a symbol of God's favour and of the nation's inviolability under a Virgin Queen. However, the victory was not a turning point in the war, which continued and often favoured Spain. The Spanish still controlled the southern provinces of the Netherlands, and the threat of invasion remained. Sir Walter Raleigh claimed after her death that Elizabeth's caution had actually impeded the war against Spain. He said, "If the late Queen would have believed her men of war as she did her scribes, we had in her time beaten that great empire into pieces and made their kings of figs and oranges as in old times. But Her Majesty did all by halves, and by petty invasions taught the Spaniard how to defend himself and to see his own weakness." So a little bit of bitterness there from Sir Walter Raleigh. I don't know if there was any personal animosity there against her. Though some historians have criticised Elizabeth on similar grounds, Raleigh's verdict has more often been judged unfair. Elizabeth had good reason not to place too much trust in her commanders, who once in action tended, as she put it herself, to be transported with a haviour of vain glory. So they thought that they were much better than they actually were. I think we had that same accusation as well at other points when we had the British Empire. In 1589, the year after the Spanish Armada, Elizabeth sent to Spain the English Armada, or the Counter Armada, with 23,375 men and 150 ships, led by Sir Francis Drake as Admiral and Sir John Norreys as General. The English fleet suffered a catastrophic defeat, with 11,000 to 15,000 killed, wounded or died of disease, and 40 ships sunk or captured. The advantage England had won upon the destruction of the Spanish Armada was lost, and the Spanish victory marked a revival of Philip II's naval power through the next decade. And I think that ties in with the fact that that the sailors weren't paid after that first one. And then when they sent out this second one, they ended up losing, not too good. Then we move into Ireland. Although Ireland was one of her two kingdoms, Elizabeth faced a hostile and in places virtually autonomous Irish population that adhered to Catholicism and was willing to defy her authority and plot with her enemies. Her policy there was to grant land to her courtiers and prevent the rebels from giving Spain a base from which to attack England. In the course of a series of uprisings, Crown forces pursued scorched earth tactics, burning the land and slaughtering man, woman and child. During a revolt in Munster led by Gerald Fitzgerald, 14th Earl of Desmond in 1582, an estimated 30,000 Irish people starved to death. The poet and colonist Edmund Spenser wrote that the victims were brought to such wretchedness as that any stony heart would have rued the same. Elizabeth advised her commanders that the Irish, that rude and barbarous nation, be well treated, but she or her commanders showed no remorse when putting down rebellions. Between 1594 and 1603, Elizabeth faced her most severe test in Ireland during the Nine Years' War, a revolt that took place at the height of hostilities with Spain, who backed the rebel leader Hugh O'Neill, Earl of Tyrone. In spring of 1599, Elizabeth sent Robert Devereux, 2nd Earl of Essex, to put the revolt down, but to her frustration, he made little progress and returned to England in defiance of her orders. He was replaced by Charles Blount, Lord Mountjoy, who took 3 years to defeat the rebels, and O'Neill finally surrendered in 1603, a few days after Elizabeth's death. Soon after, a peace treaty was signed between England and Spain. And I think Ireland always provided problems as well. They were the last to receive help to actually improve the country after Wales and Scotland. They were always seen as like the last place that the King of England wanted to go to, even though it was supposedly the King of England's realm. But a lot of the time, as it says here, it was virtually autonomous. And when the English would go over there, they would just end up having fights with the Irish. But the problem was, with a nation like that that was rebelling against the king, they could allow the Spanish in there, and then you'd have the Spanish and the Irish against the English.
I think that reflects a lack of statesmanship, really, on the part of Elizabeth. The fact of the matter is, if you've got a nation that's composed of certain factions that don't readily support you, then part of the solution to that is that you've got to concentrate on winning their hearts, basically, and also of securing the land. You know, and you mentioned about how we still controlled parts of France in those days. Well, the way in which those sort of issues were sorted out by the Romans, for example, was that they would create garrison towns all along the furthest borders of their empire, and you know, that set an example for other powers following the fall of the Roman Empire. But and that's really what should have been done by Elizabeth. She should have created garrison towns all along the border of in France, where her realm ended, in order to prevent that sort of thing. And so and she needed to make sure that those garrison towns were led by people that she could trust to be loyal to her. And the same thing should have been done in Ireland. They should have had, you know, Ireland should have had a number of garrison towns, particularly around the western border of Ireland, where it's abuts the sea, in order to prevent the Spanish from coming ashore. And that's obviously something that she failed to do.
Yeah, I think it's something Edward I did when he was in France, built lots of new towns and actually developed new settlements. But again, he failed to do that in Ireland. He failed to do what he'd done in France in Ireland. I think all the monarchs did, really. They just ended up trying to force the Irish to do what they wanted them to do with weapons, instead of helping them out with investment.
And the other thing to have done as well would have been to have created a capital city for the British Isles in Ireland. If you create your capital city in the part of your realm which is least loyal to you, then that very fact that you've done that will help to strengthen your realm and your lands by virtue of the fact that the people who have tended to trust you least will, through constant contact with you, come to trust you more, and it will create a much more stable country.
Yeah, I think, again, I think the problem was just getting enough people over there to do something like that and paying them. I mean, Ireland was part of the British realm on paper, but I think most of the time it was just ungovernable, because everybody was in England, Scotland and Wales, and they had enough problems with Scotland and Wales. By the time they managed to get rid of them and try to get over to Ireland, they'd run out of funds to pay these armies that they had. Well, moving to Russia, Elizabeth continued to maintain the diplomatic relations with the Tsardom of Russia that were originally established by her half-brother Edward VI. She often wrote to Ivan the Terrible on amicable terms, although the Tsar was often annoyed by her focus on commerce rather than on the possibility of a military alliance. The Tsar even proposed to her once, and during his later reign asked for a guarantee to be granted asylum in England should his rule be jeopardised. And there is a long history of alliance, actually, between Russia and England. And we also have Muslims here. Trade and diplomatic relations developed between England and the Barbary states during the rule of Elizabeth, based upon the dictum that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. England established a trading relationship with Morocco in opposition to Spain, selling armour, ammunition, timber and metal in exchange for Moroccan sugar, in spite of a papal ban. Diplomatic relations were also established with the Ottoman Empire, with the chartering of the Levant Company and the dispatch of the first English ambassador to the port, William Harborne, in 1578. For the first time, a treaty of commerce was signed in 1580. Numerous envoys were dispatched in both directions, and epistolar exchanges occurred between Elizabeth and Sultan Murad III. In one correspondence, Murad entertained the notion that Islam and Protestantism had much more in common than either did with Roman Catholicism, as both rejected the worship of idols, and he argued for an alliance between England and the Ottoman Empire. To the dismay of Catholic Europe, England exported tin and lead for cannon casting and ammunition to the Ottoman Empire, and Elizabeth seriously discussed joint military operations with Murad III during the outbreak of war with Spain in 1585, as Francis Walsingham was lobbying for a direct Ottoman military involvement against the common Spanish enemy. So what we see here is even back then they were using proxy armies and trying to make alliances with other countries that were at odds with the countries that we were at war with. Rather like funding Ukraine to go against Russia at the moment, funding ISIS to go against Syria, funding the moderate rebels, I guess, to go against Libya. And this was going on all the way back then, trying to get on side with the Muslims. And I guess this alliance would have continued, because by the time you get into the later British Empire, and General Gordon, he was working for the Ottomans at some point, wasn't he? And I'm not sure when the slavery was going on. I mean, this could when England was allied with the Ottomans here and with the Barbary states. I do think this is around about the time that we had those states were going to Europe and snatching people off the coasts and taking them back as slaves. I think there was white slavery going on at this time. So not much loyalty to the other Europeans there from Elizabeth.
Yeah, it seems to be a very volatile situation with without anybody pursuing any kind of grand strategy, doesn't it? Apart from sort of just fighting with your immediate neighbour and looking the other side of your immediate neighbour to see if there's somebody else that you can link up with that will attack them from the other side. It's a bit disappointing, really.
Yeah, not very well developed. And of course, you also got to remember that she's a woman, and she does say that. She says, I'm just a woman, but I will do my best at these sort of manly things. And she didn't do too well. I mean, the country did not get invaded, and we defended ourselves against the Armada. So she didn't do too badly militarily. Yeah. Well, I think we'll leave that there for this week, Max. So thank you very much for coming on today.
That's right. My pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back after Easter with a new Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.